Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor. For the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris Effects products for more than 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, we're talking with three of the editors of the Disney Plus series Andor, John Gilroy, ACE, Jan Miles, ACE, and Simon Smith. John Gilroy, ACE, is an editor and also a producer on the series. He was nominated for a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie for the feature film Michael Clayton, and he was nominated for an Ace Eddie and a BAFTA for Nightcrawler. His feature work includes Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Suicide Squad, Pacific Rim, The Bourne Legacy, and Salt, among many others. Jan Miles, ACE, has edited some of the great TV series of recent years, including Game of Thrones and Band of Brothers. He won an Emmy and was nominated for an Ace Eddie for The Crown, and won an Emmy, a BAFTA, and an Ace Eddie for Sherlock. Simon Smith has been on Art of the Cut before when he won the Emmy, the BAFTA, and the Ace Eddie for Chernobyl. He also recently won the Ace Eddie for cutting the One Way Out episode of Andor. Before I hop into our discussion with John, Jan, and Simon, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in one low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, John Gilroy, ACE, Jan Miles, ACE, and Simon Smith on editing Andor. What I'd like to do is have you each introduce yourselves, because no one will be able to see you, so I want to be able to put people's names associated with a voice.
Hello, I'm John Gilroy. I'm co-producer and editor on Andor.
Hi, I'm Jan Miles, and I'm one of the many editors of Andor Season 1.
Hi, everyone. I'm Simon Smith, and I'm another one of the editors of Andor Season 1, episodes 9 and 10.
John, I was just named associate producer on a show that I just cut. How does that happen, and what extra work does it entail?
Tony Gilroy is the showrunner, and I've basically edited everything that Tony's done. My job is I edit several of the episodes. I think I edited 4. I'm also sort of overviewing everything and just, you know, making sure that everything flows right. I'm also finishing all the shows. All the shows will eventually filter back to me. We do all the VFX and the music and the mixing. So I'm sort of overseeing the whole process. I'm on like from the very, very beginning. And I'm the last to leave. And everybody else sort of comes and goes. They come in and they cut their episode and they do great. And then they're on to another job.
And do you think that he trusts you and needs another set of eyes? Or what do you think that producing credit is for?
I've always been a very hands-on editor. The first few small films, you're doing these low-budget films, and you have to wear a lot of hats. You don't have a post-production supervisor. You don't have a music editor. So you really have to do a lot of things on your own, and you move the ball forward. And it's being an editor, but also being a manager of a department, which is basically what you're doing. You're just trying to be a good sheriff and make sure everybody's happy, but make sure the work's going along and I'm a producer that instead of just giving you a note, if it was like sometimes, you know, editors, you know, we can climb inside the footage and you can see things that you can't see from the outside. And sometimes it's about examining something and then going, oh, you know, what about this or what about that? But that's primarily my job.
I think one of the difficulties in cutting sci-fi or fantasy would be, because I've done neither, that you've got all these weird words and, you know, weird worlds. Is it still just the same sense of truthfulness that you get from having to deal with all of the science fiction elements?
I think Tony's writing's truthful. That's where it starts. It's like something you can touch. It has a protein. It's credible. You know, I understand we've got aliens, we've got spaceships and that, but at the heart of it, the sort of narrative is current. It sort of runs and chimes with oppression and the social dysfunctions and the Ukraine and all these parallels, which is what sci-fi tends to lead into. But sometimes it can be kind of watered down by science fiction itself. This narrative is pretty solid in its own. And I think that comes from Tony, comes from the scripts. And that's what I took from when I watched Rogue One, when I came on board. That's the first thing I said to John in the meeting was that this sort of, it feels solid, relatable. The dialogues are relatable.
I totally agree with Jan. Like the scripts were amazing. And this is Star Wars. And definitely it's got the war element in the whole thing. Like Tony's a big war and history buff. He knows his First World War history, Second World War history. My episodes were set in a prison. And they arrested the main character just up off the street for no real reason. And the thing that I took from that is it was slave camps. It was putting people into the gulag, basically, and making them work for the empire. And I think that's what so many people have taken away from the writing in Andor is the history allegories that are in there. That's right, isn't it, John? Like, it's more than just a hobby, but a fascination and interest in history and in war.
Yeah, I mean, it's in that context, but it's also just really good storytelling. And what he's really good at is, I'd say we have no two-dimensional characters in our show. Everybody is really fleshed out, and it's really about human interaction and being a really good student of human interaction. And that truth that you're talking about, that's where it lies, you know, in the strength of our show. Sometimes you're working on something and the writing is uneven and the character is really smart and then they're not so smart. You know, it's like, what happened there? Like, why'd they do that? We have none of that. We gut check ourselves all the time. I mean, it's in the writing, but it's also in how we build the shows and fixing things along the way. And that's the truth. It's really the human element, which is weird because it's all about aliens. So,
it's not really science fiction, Steve.
Now, there's a lot of Star Wars fans that were up as all sorts of
things. Yeah. Because so many of these Star Wars stories are tied together, do you feel the need to watch all the other shows, or do you know the timelines and you watch specific films or TV series, or you just worry about your episode?
I dip into the other episodes out of curiosity, but our timeline is really this finite loop. When Rogue One ends, New Hope begins like 5 minutes later. So, and then this is the 5-year journey before Rogue One. So we're in our own little universe. And we, you know, within that context, because there's been all sorts of different time jumps in the Star Wars canon, but we brush against things that we're supposed to brush against. We keep our eye on the ball. You know, I mean, we're talking about Diego Luna's character and the people that he meets along the way and his transformation from just a guy who's not doing very much to becoming like this revolutionary hero.
I watched the first three, the Lucas, you know, the Star Wars Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi as a young man. And that had a huge effect on me. I mean, Empire Strikes Back was the first film I think I watched as a sort of young boy. The bad guys won. It was just bizarre. I'd never had that twist of fate. I didn't watch the rest of the Star Wars, and that's no judgment of that. I grew up with other films, but I came back to Rogue One. And Rogue One's what pulled me back to those films. And I think, and that in turn, in Andor, feels to me some of those similarities of those first three, whatever the order of all those other episodic versions are, they're the ones I can personally relate to. And that's even not in the correct order, because Rogue One goes before them, doesn't it? So, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. That's how emotionally I engage in it. It's that what the effect of those films had on me is how I perceive the sort of editing and the storytelling I lean into with Andor.
John said that he's like first editor in and last editor out. I was the other way around. I was the last editor in and the, out much earlier than John was. But when I came in, I think everyone else had already been working and had probably found what the series was. And joining the series, like, I'm working with super editors like John Gilroy and Jan Maas and Fran Parker and Tim Porter and so on. And for me, it was like, oh, I mustn't mess this up. I've got to really, like, punch up with these brilliant guys. There was one day when Jan came in, into my room and he said, Simon, have you been watching my episode? And I was like a little rabbit in headlights and, you know, a little bit embarrassed, to be honest. And I was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. Because he caught me off guard completely. And yes, yeah, and I obviously.
yeah, you left a paper trail behind you. That was sick.
I had a look at Jan's episode and I'd looked at John's episode and everyone's episode because
I'm pretty sure I said you can watch it as long as you ask, right? I think.
Oh yeah, no, well that's a stupid thing as well. If I just asked him, it would have been fine, and I know it would have been fine. But I think there's maybe, admittedly, a lot of people will probably know this. There might be a bit of first day anxiety or first day nerves on a job, especially when you're working on Star Wars. You know, this is like a big deal on Andor. It was always super important to me to make sure that I was delivering at the standard and so on, especially of the people around me. I've been holding that in, Jan, for about a year.
Yeah, well, the good news, Simon, is it worked rather well for you, didn't it? So
I'm very lucky to have such brilliant editors to learn from and talk things through. And for me, very much an experience like that, especially with John and Jan and Fran Parker as well. You know, she's an incredible, well-known editor here in the UK and in the States. So, yeah, so I did watch all the episodes in the series.
Good thing. It's a good thing to know. It's actually encouraged on some level. I mean, why would you really hold it back? You want to give everybody as much context as possible. And the more you know about somebody else's episode that's preceding yours, the more you're going to understand your own. So it's like it's only good filmmaking.
With the secrecy of the Star Wars universe, did all of you get a chance to read all of the scripts or no?
The scripts were super secret. You could not get your hands on a script, and there were no paper scripts sort of floating around. But I think everybody, if you were working, you wanted to understand the aperture of things as you go through.
It was a little bit more difficult for me because we did block two. So John was in with Tim, and block two consisted of episode 7, 11, and 12. And I was doing 11 and 12. So I was doing the end before some of those scripts had been flashed out. And I was probably putting quite a lot of fires out in that process, you know, in the edit. So I didn't have much time. And John, you were probably deep in your fine cut at that point. So Simon, you hadn't even arrived at that point. So it was quite bizarre to be doing a finale in a block two slot.
It was a little premature, right? It didn't hurt you.
No, I just trusted what Tony's words were, I guess, and what he would talk about with Ben, the director. I would just lean and trust into that. I do remember Tony's words were, I can't believe I've locked the last episode of the show at the beginning of the process, which is pretty bizarre in television. That doesn't often happen. So
we've said this before in other interviews. We didn't, and not to keep blowing smoke at Tony Gilroy, but the scripts really were tight and it was a great battle plan and you really could rely on them. And that they threw quite a bit of money at this for television. It's like we made 4 movies in 2 years. That's the way I look at it. And it looks really good, but there's not a lot of, we're going to shoot it and find it in the cutting room. And we all worked on movies like this sort of loose and you're restructuring. And there was really none of that. I mean, we had basically used every scene we shot. I mean, every scene is in the show, which is like kind of incredible. And we really did stick to the plan. And because we could stick to the plan, we could use all our resources to really, you know, for VFX and everything pushed the ball forward. It wasn't like we were zigzagging, trying to find where we were supposed to be. So that's probably why Jan was able to do the last episode so early and we still land on our feet, you know, at the end.
We're so far away from it now, but we were editing during COVID as well. As post-production, we were pretty much in our own little bubble. We weren't working at home because having Star Wars sent out to all of our homes might not be the best plan. So the UK editors were all at Pinewood and we were all like in our COVID bubble together. We'd all have lunch together outside on the lawns in Pinewood. And because of that, it did allow for all of those conversations to help understand what's my character doing here or what did he do in your episode or how is this working? I felt, certainly when I joined at the end and everyone was already on it, in such a easy position to ask Jan and Fran and Dan and Matt and so on, but also even the assistants were all over it in terms of characters and locations and story arc. So for me, it was quite easy in that regard, in a lovely, you know, perfect way, really.
Jan mentioned the block shooting, and I would love for listeners to get some understanding of what you mean by that and how those blocks were determined and what the schedule was.
This is sort of the architecture of the show, and it didn't start out being like this, but it seemed to all of a sudden become a pattern, and it really worked well. We would do blocks, like the first three episodes would be considered a block. There's sort of a story arc that goes and builds from the first episode to the second, comes to a climax in the third. There's some sort of resolution, and then there's a page turn, and you're into the next block, four, five, six. And it was really great because these page turns, they were like totally different environments. I mean, Simon was in prison the whole time, like one of the most diabolical prisons I could ever imagine. And so that's what you mean by a block. Seven was sort of the outlier. Seven was sort of the standalone, not quite part of Simon's block. Fran did that episode. That's sort of the transitional thing after the heist and whatever. But the rest of them were sort of, you could think of them in blocks.
Yeah. So you had like an origin film, which was episodes 1, 2, 3. You had the heist, which was 4, 5, 6. 8, 9, and 10 was the prison. And then, you know, the grand finale of Jan's 11 and 12. Between those four blocks, and each of those had a different director pretty much. So I could work with the other editor on my block, Matt, and just talk about prison stuff and Andy Serkis.
Can you guys talk a little bit about the advantages or the disadvantages of a team of editors working on the same project?
First of all, there are multiple editors because there's multiple episodes. These guys, their episodes were there. So like I'm giving notes or whatever, but then later I'm sort of inheriting their work and then we're finishing it sonically and musically. But everybody has their own thing, but yet basically everybody's in the same place. It was weird for me. I was in New York with Tony for the bulk of the shooting because of COVID. And I just see these guys on Zoom calls for about 6 or 7 months.
Well, I think it's really interesting what Simon said is that even though we were sort of in COVID in the lockdown, it kind of brought us together. I think most of the information is osmosis. It's not sort of not what's being said. It's the bits between.
Right.
I think as Simon says, probably all the assistants carried that conduit between us. There's a lot of the assistants really enjoy Star Wars as well, which is pretty amazing, right? So
one of them came to work the other day for the fourth Be With You, like in costume.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. I mean,
yeah.
That's like, I didn't know about the fourth Be With You, but that's a Star Wars unofficial holiday or something.
I don't know if Steve knows. It's May the 4th. He does know. Okay.
Yeah. May the 4th be with you. Yep.
You know, all of a sudden they're in costume and I see Clea or I see, you know, Darth Vader or whatever. I'm like, wow.
It's strangely that what I've found and what I'm discovering now, post-COVID, a lot of productions have sort of have kept editors at home. You know, there's a choice, right? And look, I used to cut from home pre-COVID, right? I used to do sort of 4 days. If I had like a really crazy idea, you know, I'd have it on a hard drive, I'd go back to my studio at home in the garden, and I'd sort of splash out a scene with inspiration at sort of 10 p.m. at night, you know, or something, or sort of 6:30 in the morning, because I couldn't do it in the confines of my cutting room in Soho with sort of copy machines and people asking you to go out. So, but through it, strangely, post-COVID, now it's sort of gone away, is actually some of us have gone off and still stay separate. I think it's a little bit harmful in a way because people are being further apart.
All being apart all the time could never be as good as being at work.
No.
John mentioned as well how we were given, you know, our own episodes to work on. And there is something I feel that comes from that, to be trusted and to be given. And I think this comes from because John is also an editor and knows exactly how we all think, right? He knows how if you give something to someone to be proud of and to own to some extent, they will work their ass off and do that for you. And I think there is certainly shows where there's a lot more collaboration and sharing going on. But when you start to feel like you're just the person operating the machine today, it's not really, I think.
Yeah, you need to take ownership. And my personal theory is that the best things, the best movies, the best shows probably have a smaller brain trust, you know, just having a core bunch of people, you know, the director, showrunner, few people, but not a lot of people weighing in. And that Tony and I have always tried to keep it like that for ourselves with the movies we've done. And we just sort of applied it to this. I mean, I don't know.
I always remember sort of speaking to John in the battlefield. I was in the thick of it. And I sometimes sort of go, he go, how are you? And I go, yeah, I'm in the thick of this. And he's going, well, I'm sure you know what you're doing. That would be what he was always saying, you know, and it was like a huge reassurance. That comes from experience. And that comes from that. Again, that is, they're small things, but they're huge things. You can go down the wrong path very quickly, you know, and not know it. So it's not saying I often do, but it can, it can happen. It can happen. Yes.
I was thinking when talking about being separated and being at home is one of the hardest groups probably affected by that is the assistants. They're doing their job and they're really not getting the interaction with the editor as much as they normally would. And they're not seeing the editor director relationship as much as they normally would.
I actually started on film. So I used to cut on moviolas, hate to date myself, but back then you really had a lot more interaction with, as a first assistant, you were kind of like a nurse in an operating room. Yeah. You really got to see how it was done. So already with nonlinear machines, there's already a bit of removal. You're not in the room. I mean, it's a different sort of interaction. We interact really well with our assistants, but it's a different thing. But yeah, you take one more step where everybody's at home doing it by themselves. It's like, I mean, you really must feel like you're in a vacuum sometimes.
Yeah, we all had our own like individual first assistant. And then we had like shared second assistants and we had a shared like dailies assistant and so on. And my first assistant throughout was Craig Ferreira, who I'd worked with on Chernobyl. He would sit in the room with me and we would watch the rushes together. So I'd get in and he'd have it all lined up and we'd watch the rushes down together. We'd talk about the scenes that had come in. We'd talk about any of the notes that come in. And then quite often I'd divvy it up and say, okay, well, can you go and assemble this one and I'll take these two or whatever. And Craig's fantastic. Craig stayed on for series two. He's working with John now on series two. And
he's going to be an editor on block four.
Oh, so congratulations.
He's great.
The big bump up.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's fantastic.
I do that here. I've got a second and first in assembly because I'm doing three episodes. And we all talk about it in the morning. And that, like I said, I mean, look, I'm sure we can set that up in some sort of digital streaming way. But it's who turns up late with the coffee. It's sort of sorrowful look on their face, you know, before we press play. It's under their skin in every single way. Everything I do, when it comes back, I mean, the embarrassing part for me is the assistants give it back and then I recut it. And then the director comes in and asks it back how the assistant had it. That's the that's what one should be very careful about. No, they're so good. They are really good. I mean, and they're like Swiss Army knives. I mean, my assistants, they can do comps. They can do track. We've got 34 tracks, 28 tracks of music and sound. And they manage it so well.
Let's get into the craft a little bit. Intercutting is one of my passions of discussing because I think that changes so much from script, but maybe that didn't happen on this. It sounds like the script was pretty seriously locked, but did you find in editorial you were finding better moments to cut back and forth between stories or?
I'd love to say yes, but no, not at all. on my episode, I've said before to you, Steve, that I have cards on the wall that show each scene. And I remember the wall filled up with each scene, and then it didn't change. I never moved those cards at all. The thing I really love about Star Wars in general is, as a storytelling piece, and this goes back to the original films as well, as Jan said, and it's what I call Star Wars editing, and it's where you're in one story and then you kind of peak with adrenaline and interest in what's happening in that story. And then it's like, meanwhile, back at the ranch over here, Luke and so on are in a trash compactor, and then meanwhile somewhere else we're doing this in Andor. It's just as Cassian is about to, something's going to happen, meanwhile we go over to Bix or Dedra and so on. And I love that. If I get a script that has got those storylines that kind of interweave and the peak when we then go somewhere else, it allows you to craft a real ride in the episode, you know, something that as a viewer you can like experience and strap in and really enjoy. I mean, I know definitely in Yan's finale, the ride of that final episode.
Rick's Road probably had a bit more movement and swing. It was like a combination of, I think the first sort of 15 scenes before Cassian comes back, it had Wilmot building the bomb that Ben shot in macro shots. That was just one scene. I had to cut that whole flurry of scenes with the bomb. So I started to do it a little bit, and then Tony was like, make the bomb the thread, you know, and it was kind of like, I was like, yeah, I'm done with that. We started, you know, these beautiful macro lenses of Cassian represented, the bomb sort of represented him, the sort of arrival of him and the sort of kaboom at the end is going to be his kind of coming back. So that was a big shift around in the script. And then I think with the New Orleans marching band, I mean, that had four or five different processes in. You know, it started off with, I had ADs walking around film sets. It was filmed on iPhones of people walking around the set. So we kind of blocked it out because Tony wrote the piece of music first. Him and Nicholas Patel wrote that piece of music for the marching band. So I had this piece of music and then I had all this iPhone footage that I pieced together. And then they recorded the band live in the field in the back lot so they could kind of get the sense of the instruments playing live and being outside. And they brought the band in that played the instruments and they had microphone, you know, click tracks and little things in their ears and they played along with it. So I kind of had the spine of it already. So it was kind of integral that all that stuff from my iPhone version followed the music. But of course, when those cameras came out and those long lenses came out, everything changes. You know, I'm like, I want to be on this shot and this guy's not playing the instrument at that point. If I pulled at one shot, it would pull everything apart. It's like a music video, I guess. It's sort of like a playback track, but it was sort of complex because obviously it's not just putting the musicians in, I had to put all the characters and weave them in and out. And you know, the script is a guide when it comes to that. You know, obviously, I had a journey from here to here. But
you can only come so close when you're with a thing. I mean, there was a lot of prep, all the choreography. That's why it looks great. But the chaos and all the other stuff, that you kind of got to hose down a little bit. And then that stuff you do kind of have to find in the cutting room. I mean,
there was a piece of music that was called Forming Up. It was in the middle of this. There's a lots of different sections. It's just before they start walking down the Ricks Road where they do the sort of pipe section. It was extraordinary. They all formed up in that section. There was a piece of music that I could not get to work. And I've never told anyone that I've dropped it. I just dropped this whole section because I went from one to the other. Tony never even batted and I never even said anything. It just worked seamlessly.
I got to make a phone call. Hold on.
Yeah, it was only short. No one ever rang up. So. But strangely, yeah, that order, that musical order, that musical rhythm was hard. I mean, look, John, you've done lots of action. Simon, action sort of, it's strange. Dialogues are harder than action, but music and movement, that's something I never kind of slightly, I've done versions of it. But to sort of swing around and howl around. And then when we finish the song, then we have Fiona Shaw as a hologram doing a sort of monologue. And then I had to swing around everyone again. And it was just, I was like, when does this beast end? You know, it wouldn't. And then it turns into a war after that. So, and Fiona's performance was that started off as she, Ben was on set, recorded her voice. I cut all of that on a wild track. And some of it actually stayed, even when we refitted some of that performance. She was so good on that very first read, so emotive that I kept it because it was the hologram on the reverses. I could use it. But it was like onion layer after onion layer with Rick's Road. And when anyone gave a note, you get pulled at everything around it.
That's why you're always crying. Now it all makes sense.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. When Bix, she hummed the song, you know, to it at the same time in the sort of prison window, you know, sort of. And I sort of played it slightly out of sync from the music, you know, because she was so mentally tortured.
It was perfect.
And those little parts like that are so delicate and so detailed. So there's something imperfect about that music, being live, being played again. It's like a sort of IRA funeral march or something, you know, it has that sort of corresponding kind of parallels to it, you know. So that had some swings and changes, but ultimately a great guide, you know, the guide, the backbone of it, you know. And Tony weirdly recording the music before anything started was just extraordinary.
I wanted to talk about the idea of those dialogue scenes. You were saying how difficult they are to cut sometimes, especially when you don't have just two people looking at each other, when you've got a trio or even more, four or five. Talk about trying to build those scenes using eye lines, what kind of coverage maybe you're getting, and how you use that to amplify what's being said with the storytelling of the shots you're using, not just the performances.
Yeah, I love that scene. And mainly I love that scene. As John said earlier, how every character is rich and has their own backstory and history and stuff like that. The Davos guy doesn't appear in many episodes, but that actor is so good, like so, so good. Whenever he turns up, the casting is brilliant. So I would have had two cameras on a lot of it, and Toby, the director, and the first AD, they would have absolutely properly covered it. You know, there's not a single beat missing. So there's never a moment that I didn't have. You know, it's not like I'm trying to patch something or cover something up. If I want to be on this person at this time, I know I can. So I cut with script sync. So all of that scene is lined up to the script. And I just start by watching the rushes and feeling my way through it. And where do I feel something? What moment in what take do I feel something? Oh, like, you know, that bit's really strong or really connected with me. I'll note that down during the dailies or between me and the assistant. One of us will mention, oh, that was brilliant. So then you mentally note it down. I'll open up the script sync and basically just block it out from the script sync. I'll know, okay, I want to be on this character here. I want to cut to this person here. Da, 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 da. So because of the script sync, the amount of time invested in watching the dailies and in the assistants setting the script sync up, my bit's quite quick. I find that kind of cutting quite easy. John, Jan, do you use script sync in that same way for those dialogue scenes?
No, the assistants take about 4 years to make it, don't they? It's sort of, it's...
Every time you want it, you're like, you have it? Like, no, it's not going to be for that. You're like,
not my assistants.
Yeah.
John's
got in that little mini timeline that you get in your source window, I kind of, as long as I have a marker on action, I kind of have my inbuilt script sync. I go that third, that line's at that point. So I block it out in my way, as in a sort of timeline block. If it's lots of dialogue, I go back, but I use the blocking first to take me back.
Oh, interesting.
And then question the performances and just go between those performances. But performance comes from me, comes from the delivery of the actor as one whole piece. And I have to stick with that. I mean, strangely, I'm sort of more led by, A, the lens and the framing and the shot, as well as I am, you know, the context of, if it's on a long lens, it reads a certain way. If I'm on a profile, it's a sort of another way. So script sync doesn't necessarily give me that.
I use script sync. When I do use it, well, I don't use it all the time. I often use it after I'm done or I think I'm done. I can usually figure out the architecture of the scene very quickly. And I will build the scene and just hit a take until it's good enough. That's good enough. And I sort of flesh the whole thing out, get the architecture the way it's going to be or the way I think it's going to be. For me, it's numbers of passes, you know, a first pass, a second pass, a third pass. Maybe a fourth pass, but the fourth pass, I usually feel like I rang it out.
And you've nailed it.
Got it.
John is actually script sync. he is script sync. That's what
it is. I am.
But Simon, I think it's like the method is kind of the same. Because Simon, you're just doing it around the other way. You're going down with one path, but you're confident of that path because you're doing it in the sort of live, die, repeat of it. So I think it's sort of, in many ways, we're just doing the reverse engineer of that. We're going down a sort of outline. So then going via the sort of process, like John saying 4 or 5 passes, and you're kind of there. But I like what John says when he says about the architecture is good material teaches you the architecture, doesn't it? Like, well, good director kind of leaves it in there sometimes. And sometimes I surprise the director. So I go, I didn't do that. And they're like, you didn't do this anything like I want it, but I like it. That's sometimes the case. But sometimes it sort of speaks to you in the way that they plan it, in the way it's sort of broken down and set out, and that kind of helps you in a way, I guess.
I had quite a few monologue moments, even in that Davos scene, that there's moments where it's one character talking and talking, and you're kind of holding on that for as long as you can. I did love that about how well written these scenes were, that you could really, really suck people into just holding on a take or sitting with someone, and then just as that gets to, like, you know, the moment. You can then cut to the reaction or to see what Mon was doing or in other scenes later on, what Robert M's character was doing. And that comes from those longer, I think, monologue type parts of the dialogue in my episodes.
It was a really good scene, wasn't it? It was electric, that scene.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes in the whole season. That, and obviously Luthen's, when he dresses down young in the elevator.
Yeah.
I mean, those two scenes are just like among many fantastic scenes. I mean, many.
But I got a Stellan Skarsgård and an Andy Serkis monologue in episode 10. I saw someone write on Twitter, just as you think you've seen the best monologue in Star Wars with Andy Serkis, you get another one from Stellan Skarsgård. So it was brilliant. And, you know, I'd been fortunate enough to had Stellan Skarsgård do equally brilliant monologues in Chernobyl. So it is something that I've been lucky to cut a couple of times, really.
Yeah, I thought about that monologue outside the elevator, because obviously the performance is so strong, but then you're also trying to make it visually interesting beyond that with the reactions, with great production design, you know, that you're trying to, you know, not show off. You've got it there to look at if you want to go to a wider shot.
What I really liked was and it wouldn't have been my first instinct, was the jump cuts in the elevator.
I noticed those too, yep.
Was a little artier than, like, I was like, first time I saw it, I was like, oh, But you know what? Watched it a couple of times. It really was like very effective. It just set up the paranoia and it disoriented you in the right way. It really put you in Young's shoes. So when that door opens, he's just sort of...
So Toby was a director and, you know, we all get our notes from the script supervisor through. And the note on the day was, just use this take in one go.
Gem cut it.
Yeah, he didn't want me to cut it at all. He was just like, this is a take. This is great. Just use this one. But I thought, well, you know, I've still got another 6 hours of work on the clock today. You know, I should try something.
Get paid by the cut. So of course you want to make
three bucks. Get paid by the cut. Yeah, I get paid by the cut. So I think very much, I'm sure this is the same with a lot of people on these shows. You come in the morning, you've got the three scenes that they shot the day before, and that day you want to get through those three scenes because the next day you have another three scenes from the next day's shoot. You're kind of always editing one day behind the camera and you're keeping up to camera that way. So I would always like, if I had a single cut that could work, I would then be like, okay, well, let's use an hour to just experiment and see what else we could do. Sometimes I'm jump cutting, but within the same take. I think often it's within the same take as well. It's not to a different take necessarily. It's like...
So you're obeying Toby is what you're saying.
You know, taking a second out just to shuffle it around a bit.
Well, I mean, the other thing, of course, I think about when you get a note from a director saying, just use this, it's pretty clear direction. But as long as you have that to show them, right, it's okay. Because if they go, oh, those jump cuts, I hate those. You can go, oh, well, here's the one take that you wanted. It's there. We're done, right? You can kind of get yourself out of jail.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was because Simon really wanted to get to that great scene and he just couldn't wait. And he just was like rushing that fucking elevator.
Yeah, speed up.
Toby's one shot is no more one shot. It's three shots.
Yeah, there's no way I'll let him do it in a one. I'm going to stamp the edit on there whether I need to or not. Yeah.
Yeah, I had an assistant show me this. Like I've done very visceral jump cutting for different reasons, you know, but they showed me the one where they sort of had a little morph blend or something, you know, you kind of stuck on a little move and I was just like, that's ridiculous. You could be out by quite a bit and it sort of morphed it together in the Avid. I mean, like, that I'd never seen before, like jump cuts for reasons to be sort right. of, you know, aggressively visceral, fine. And it's not like the two shots were identical. There's some pretty magical, I think it's fluid morph. Is that the function or something? I didn't even know it existed. And I put that, I was like, that's pretty cool. That is.
What do you think your peers are looking at, or what are you looking at when you are trying to judge someone else's work for things like the Eddies, the Oscars, the BAFTAs, and the ACES?
You're not really looking like an editor. I think you're just looking like a film goer or watching television. You're looking for something that moves you and something that you really love. If you love it, it's probably well put together. What we do is invisible, usually. You're not supposed to think about what we do. Sometimes people do, you know, jump cut in an elevator. I mean, they're putting the editing up there a little bit. I think it's just about plugging in and responding to things you really love.
Jan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my feeling is it's what you sort of said at the beginning of this conversation. It's sort of about craft. I think it's honesty. So if I watch someone's work, and it has an honesty to it, I'm sort of drawn in and it sort of holds me. And I don't feel, I guess I don't want to be held. I don't want to have a hand. You know, I just want to be taken on the journey. And the edits disappear when I'm in the journey. And then afterwards, you realize it's storytelling. You feel, you know, it's been handled well. There's something inside it. There's something, it's always that. I think it's like a sort of core that, A, it's great storytelling and it's handled well with fantastic performances. But the editing sort of maneuvers itself out of it. But yeah, I still find myself looking in awe of it. You know, afterwards, I'm sort of like, that's pretty special. Like Simon's lift jump cuts.
I'm just looking for lift jump cuts. That's if they've done jump cut.
they get the award. Okay, I'm going to think about that because I think maybe I can get an Eddie that way.
We were up against Euphoria and Severance at the Eddies. And those two shows are so well cut and like superb, superb shows. And I think what television is doing really, really well at the moment and over the last few years, and certainly with the kind of shows that we're all fortunate enough to work on, is giving like the viewer an experience. Like you sit down and you feel like you've had an experience watching something. I certainly feel at the end of Jan's episode and also at the end of, you know, the heist in episode 6, like, had this, you know, visceral, like, body reaction to what I've just watched in an adrenaline-filled way or in an emotional way. And I do think that does come from great editing. When you get that from Severance, or when you get that from Euphoria, or you get that from any of these, like, award-winning shows, it has happened in the cutting room. You can't get that feeling from bad editing.
We build the shows. We build them. That's what we do. I mean, we're building the shows. So, of course, it's pretty important.
Going to what you're saying, Simon, I remember reading sort of people, the audience, you know, when people watch stuff like you've made, and they sort of forget to breathe, you know, it's like that. Because the sort of biorhythm of the rhythm of editing, that sort of pulsating rhythm, that human instinct is such to sort of take on a rhythm. It's sort of naturally that way. When people catch hold of that, you forget it yourself. You lean in. You lean in, don't you? It leans you in. And I, like Simon said, I think television has been fantastic for many years, but there's so many things that I see now that I just cannot help myself to lean in, and it lets everything go around me, and it sort of snaps you back out. And then what's amazing is that some of them are like 28 minutes long, and it wouldn't matter. And some of it's 60 minutes long, and it wouldn't matter. It's just good storytelling.
Jan is especially good at it as well. He wouldn't say it himself, but Jan, you know, edited The Crown and edited Sherlock, and I remember both of those episodes like vividly, and you know, just how brilliant those shows were. And that does, I'd say, of course I would say I'm an editor, but I'd say the editing plays a huge part in that. A huge part in that.
Gentlemen, I've taken up too much of your time already. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about Andor. It's been so interesting to chat about this show, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm not quite done, so I need to watch Jan's couple of episodes.
You won't be good disappointed.
You're in for a treat. Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much.
Yeah, very kind of you. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, good to see you, Simon.
Great chatting with all of you. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
guys.
Bye, everybody.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Look at the Craft of Editing. Thanks to John Gilroy, ACE, Jan Miles, ACE, and Simon Smith for joining me on Art of the Cut. Thanks to Ryan Healy for editing today's podcast. And thanks to our partner, Boris FX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And also check me out on Twitter at Steve Hullfish.